The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon. Last month, we had former MUFON Oklahoma State Director Mindy Tautvast on the show, and she talked about Project Aquarius and its co-founder, Mr. Bob Spearing. I asked if she could put me in touch with Mr. Spearing, and she was kind enough to do so. Fortunately, we have him on the show today as our guest. Mr. Spearing graduated from Fordham University with a Bachelor's of Arts in Communications, with Journalism and Film Production as major concentrations. Bob recently retired from the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey after 34 years. He has had three UFO sightings himself, and it was enough to capture his interest and research the phenomenon. Bob joined the Mutual UFO Network in 2014 as a field investigator and is currently Director of International Investigations. Bob appeared in several episodes of the 2019 Travel Channel television series UFOs, The Lost Evidence, as a photo analyst. In a recent Ancient Aliens episode on the History Channel in February, he appeared as a MUFON field investigator. He's had numerous articles published in various UFO-related magazines around the world, including four MUFON Journal cover stories, and he has appeared in several television series as a photo analyst. He has had numerous articles published in various UFO-related magazines around the world, like Outer Limits Magazine and the MUFON Journal, and has been interviewed on numerous radio and TV shows. And I'm happy to include We Are Not Alone as one of them. So, enough said. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you very much, Dave. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on. Let's start with, please tell our listeners about your personal sightings that got you interested in the phenomenon.
Back in 1986, I believe it was, I was camping in Round Valley Reservoir in a very remote section of New Jersey, just miles and miles of forest around this lake. It was raining pretty hard. I was sitting on the beach on an overturned canoe about 1 a.m, and I saw what looked like a pink star coming across the lake. But since it was raining heavy, there was low cloud cover, so I knew it couldn't be a star. It just hovered over the lake for, I'd say, a good half hour, and then it began doing crazy maneuvers, like it would drop down, stop, do a semicircle stop, like a upside down question mark, and then it eventually just shot off with a streak across the sky. I didn't know it at the time, but this was a known phenomenon in ufology. As a matter of fact, a fellow by the name of Terry Ray wrote a book on what are called orange orbs. And when I discovered this book in 2013, that's what prompted me to join MUFON. My second sighting was on a train going from New York City to Newark, New Jersey. I was going across the New Jersey Meadowlands, middle of the day, beautiful blue sky, not a cloud in the sky. And I look out the train window, and I'd say maybe 1,000 feet out, maybe 1,000 feet up, was a silver sphere, and it was just pacing the train. This was about 2012. I saw this. It was going about 60 miles an hour, and when it came out of the meadows and just about to hit the Newark skyline, it just shot up at incredible speed and over the skyline, and it was gone. So those two are nothing to write home about. The third one wasn't really a UFO, as it was on the ground, sort of. I was driving back from Quebec City. It was the middle of winter. I was going through the Adirondacks, which is just miles and miles of mountainous forests near Lake Placid. And I was the only car on the highway. And as I came around the bend, there was a clearing, and I saw a sheer rock cliff. And climbing up the cliff was this massive machine. And I'm telling you, I'm in the middle of nowhere. And it had like triangular wheels. I'd say it was the size of two tractor trailers put together, and it looked like a tank. And it was just climbing straight up a sheer cliff wall. I didn't know what it was, so I looped around back again to see if I could catch it, but it was gone by the time I got back. But that was beyond a doubt the strangest thing I ever saw in my life, in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Triangular wheels.
Yep, like it was made to climb up this cliff, whatever this thing was.
Wow. Wow. So yeah, well, that certainly was unidentified, wasn't it? An unidentified object, but that wasn't in the sky.
No, it was pretty much going up a sheer cliff.
Going up a sheer cliff. Amazing. Yeah.
And I wouldn't even know how it got there, all right? Because there was nothing else but this highway I was on. So I don't know what this thing was doing deep in the forest in the middle of the Adirondack nowhere.
So, did you relate your sightings to anyone at the time?
No, it wasn't until 2014 when I joined MUFON that I started to realize that there was a database that you could actually submit reports to. I actually had a very odd one that I found while doing genealogy research at a Mormon library. I was looking through the old baptism registers in 1864 for Jersey City's St. Peter's Parish. And at the bottom of this register, which I saw on microfilm, there was a little handwritten note below the names of the children being baptized that particular month. And it was a story about a woman looking out her window in New York City, and she related this to the parish priest. And she saw what is today's Chinatown. She saw what looked like a giant illuminated cross slowly going across the sky. So I actually printed that out, scanned it, and that was my first report to MUFON that I ever submitted, all the way back to 1864.
That's coincidental. My first report that I did as an investigator for MUFON happened to be a cross-shaped UFO. This lady said that she saw this cross heading for her barn, and it she made comment just casually to her husband, "That's going to hit the barn if it keeps going in that direction." And then it went right up over the top of the barn and gone. But it was cross-shaped. So that's rare, actually, that shape to be reported, in my estimation. What about your experience?
I'd say it's a pretty rare shape. Although I love to go back through historical reports over the centuries, and it seemed that it was more common in centuries past than it is today as a shape. And then you always have the story of how the Emperor Constantine, the Roman Emperor, converted to Christianity when he saw a giant cross in the sky. The one that was in this report from the baptism register, it said that the top of the cross, it was a crucifix shape. glowed as if there were cockpit lights on it, and it glowed from underneath. And what was interesting about that day when I looked it up in the newspapers was that there was a massive fire in that neighborhood, including a laboratory that burned down. And I have no idea what was in the laboratory. I was never able to establish that. But it's my belief that whatever this cross was in the sky, it was some sort of metallic aircraft, and that the glow from the fire in the city block below actually illuminated it so that the woman saw it in the sky. Otherwise, it would have gone undetected.
You've seen on you've watched Paranormal Caught on Camera,
No, I've never seen Paranormal Caught on Camera, but
but what?
you were going to ask me, you were going to tell
Well,
me something.
just the fact that they catch a lot of UFOs, and one of which is a pyramid shape. Pyramid shape over the Pentagon, and then the same type of thing over
Russia.
Russia. Yeah,
Yeah, I've seen those videos.
have you?
Pyramids aren't a common shape either, but there is a sufficient number in the MUFON database that I believe it's a real phenomenon. Sometimes I think that some of these triangles people see, if they saw them from a different angle, they might actually be pyramid shape.
Right. I agree with you on that. So many people say, well, this was disc shaped. No, it was flat. It was round. Like the three blind men at the side of an elephant. See it in different angles. So.
Yeah, sometimes when we get reports of orbs, we also have categories for fireballs and spheres. And when you read some of the descriptions, you wonder if people are mixing up what they're trying to describe to you between a sphere, a fireball, and a glowing orb. So.
Yeah. So do you get that with when there are multiple witnesses, different areas, the same date and time?
Well, yeah, that I'll tell you an interesting story. But first, I'll tell you that I live in the Pocono Mountains. I live near the Hudson Valley, and there's a spot on Route 84. It's a rest area at the top of a mountain, and it looks out over the whole Hudson Valley. And Hudson Valley, of course, was where the 1980s triangle sightings, the mass sightings by people pulling over on the sides of the highway. And pretty much that's right near where this rest stop is. And every once in a while, I'll go out and just look at the valley, hoping to see some UFOs, because it's been traditionally a major hot spot. What we did last year, and hopefully I'll talk about this later with Project Aquarius, is I and another field investigator went into the MUFON database. It's called the case management system, and we pulled out of the 135,000 cases now all of the drawings that people submitted, witnesses, and some of them are astonishingly good. But we discovered two things. One is that the number of shapes that people draw repeat over and over and over again. I'm not talking just about obvious ones like discs and triangles. The so-called jellyfish. There was just a video this week, jellyfish. You'd be surprised at how many jellyfishes video drawings we have, how many dumbbell drawings we have, not common shapes, but people see the same things over and over again over decades in different places in the world. And the second pattern that we discovered was that our cases go mostly chronological by case number. So case 88253, case 88254, and so on. And what we found is that in groups of numbers, say a date range of 6 months in the 88,000 case series, we'll find predominantly there'll be one shape that people are seeing over and over a certain amount of months all over the world. Sometimes it'll be triangles, sometimes it'll be something else. But it seems that shapes come in clumps, like flaps, which I also find very interesting.
But are these clumps in, let's say, for example, America and or Germany, different areas?
I would say from doing the whole experience of pulling out all those drawings, I'd say it's not necessarily regional. I'd say sometimes a phenomenon will show up at a certain time in different continents. All right, one that I'm working on now is okay. There was a case in Australia where a woman claimed that she was paralyzed, and a hooded figure came into her bedroom and began drilling behind her left ear into her skull. And then we found two other cases recently in the United States of exactly the same story, where a hooded being comes into a bedroom, paralyzed person in the bed, feels something being drilled into their skull. And while it took place, these three cases took place in a relatively short amount of time in 1 year, they were 8,000 miles apart from each other in two cases.
Does that lead you to believe that there are certain species that are visiting this planet at different times? Or is that just stretching?
No, I would not say it's stretching at all. I believe that the Earth is being visited by numerous entities or agents or whatever you want to call them. I won't necessarily call them aliens because I don't know where they come from. There's so many theories now. Are they interdimensional? Are they time travelers? So I prefer to call them agents or entities. And what I've seen, especially reading the books of Albert Rosales, the Humanoid series, that the Others Among Us, his 15 books, I believe, that go over 2,000 years of humanoid reports, you will definitely see in certain years the same type of entity repeating, and then they'll disappear for 20 years, and then they seem to come back. There was a series of cases where people beginning in 1931 and ending in 1977 saw what appeared to be clear glass globes with a man inside wearing a red suit. And we got similar reports of these over the decades, about 12 in all. The first one began in Ukraine. The last case was actually the famous Canary Islands case in the 1970s, where it was a mass sighting. But this one particular doctor in a taxi cab going to a house call actually came in contact with the glass globe. And there was the same two figures this time. It was two this time, and in the red uniforms. So there were multiple reports of glass globes with entities wearing red suits of some sort. And the other odd thing about it is that there was no obvious means of propulsion for these glass globes, almost as if they came locally from somewhere, not across the universe. Did they just, pop in and pop back out again from somewhere? Very unusual, but there was no obvious source of propulsion on these things because you could see right through them.
Would you guesstimate that that was from a mothership that was in our environs, or was that through a vortex from another dimension?
I've always leaned towards vortex from another dimension, but I think that your take on it is absolutely valid. It could have been some sort of scout ships of some sort. And if that's true, if it was scout ships, that means that the same entities were visiting the Earth over a 50-year period. If it was from a vortex, the object coming and going, it may have been that they all came to different time points on Earth, but when they all went home, they were all going back to the same place and time.
Right. Yeah, no, my take on it would be vortex as well, because in my case, it came through a vortex. But at any rate, I'm not going to get into that now because my listeners have tired of hearing it.
Let me tell you this, all right? It's like I'm writing a book, and one of my chapters is on vortexes, and there's two types of vortexes. There's indoor vortexes and there's outdoor vortexes. And I have collected newspaper clippings over 200 years where people in the outdoor type of vortexes see basically the sky open up, something come in, or something go into the vortex and the sky closes up. The indoor vortexes are usually at the beginning of an abduction experience where a person will see what looks like a spiral galaxy opening in their wall and the grays will come through. Sometimes it's not a spiral, sometimes they come in as blue or white orbs and then manifest as little grays. But I consider that there's two types of vortexes, indoor and outdoor types.
Well, if you'd like my story for your Your book, I'd be glad to send it
I
to
would, please, please. This is exactly what I'm looking for. More stories.
This was an outside vortex.
Okay.
I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Mr. Okay, Robert Spearing. Didn't know whether to call you Bob or Robert. He's with the MUFON, Michigan, not Michigan, but the International MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. And he's the head of the Project Aquarius. Bob, tell us about Project Aquarius. What exactly is that?
Well, Project Aquarius started out very innocently and small about 25 years ago. MUFON, over the decades, had collected a lot of collections from famous people, and they also kept files on what other researchers were researching. And eventually, they began to scan these items when James Carrion, back in the day, was the executive director of MUFON. And then they decided to take 6,000 pages of all of the old paper cases that were mailed in snail mail to MUFON throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, and early 90s, because nobody had ever seen these cases once they were filed. So they were all scanned, and then a special team of MUFON volunteers, including former Colorado State Director Katie Page and one of our board members, Debbie Ziegelmeyer, began redacting the names of these people and their addresses so that these items could be digitized and put up onto the internet. So, what eventually happened was we realized we had so much stuff that the paper files, the paper reports, which we originally called Project Pandora and then Project Mars, we decided to expand into Project Aquarius and make it a digital library. And there would be two ways to get it. You could buy a library card for $50 a year, or you could get a super enhanced membership with MUFON, and that would be part of the package. And basically, it's seven rooms, and six are active right now. More will be opened in the summertime. In one room, we have all of the 6,000 old paper reports that people can go through. These reports have never been seen before by the public. Room two will be a free newspaper clippings room. You don't need a membership. Anybody on planet Earth can go and access room two, which is thousands and thousands of pages of newspaper clippings spanning 400 years, actually. Room number three, we've digitized all of the MUFON journals back to 1967 when it was called Skylook Magazine, all the way up till 2010. Most people haven't seen these ever because it's not part of our original management package. They've all been scanned, so 40-something years of MUFON journals are available with this library card also. The next room are all of our symposium proceedings. The symposium is our yearly convention that we have in various parts of the United States. And those symposium program booklets go back to 1971. We've scanned all of them. They're interesting because it tells you who our speakers were back in 1975 and what the topics were that they were talking about at the time. In the summer, we're going to have a multi-level interactive UFO map. Level number one is going to be all of our 135,000 case files pegged to a globe that you can click on. A box will open and give you information about our cases. Level two, we've gotten permission from Fran Ridge of NICAP to use his chronology, which is about 6,000 cases. That will be a second level of the map. We also have a USO database that covers about 5 decades. That will be another level of the map. And AFU in Sweden, the Archives for the Unexplained, who we barter with from time to time, will be giving us these Swedish and Norwegian databases to make more levels. But the final room that I want to talk about, is the historical collections room, and that in itself is worth the money. We have acquired Captain Ruppelt's personal folders. There's 120 of them in all, of all of his personal newspaper clipping collection, his letters to other people, his investigations, his 3x5 index cards, his feelings on other researchers. It's an astonishing collection. Less well known is the John Warren collection, which is a more technically oriented collection from an old time UFO researcher that was concerned with things like propulsion systems and such. We will also in the summertime be releasing the Hayden Hughes collection, another old time 1960s, 70s, and 80s UFO investigator. We received five boxes. Banker's boxes from his widow, courtesy of Mindy Tautfest, who got it for us and is scanning them now. And we also have 40 years of MJ-12 research that MUFON did. It took up an entire file cabinet, and it's all been digitized, and it's all up right now. So the amount of collections that we have in that last room, as well as all of the collections that will be coming very soon, make this probably the largest digital collection I think available to anybody right now. It doesn't beat David Mahler's physical collection by far. If you've ever seen that guy's living room, it's like a museum. But digitized, probably the United States government might have more digitized material, and then it's MUFON.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the United States government. They're always looking for, they're always saying, well, we don't have any proof. Have you ever said, come here, I want to show you a few rooms?
Yes, we've many people know this, and some many people don't, but if you read the MUFON Journal, you would know. MUFON does not deal with the United States military or the Pentagon, anything like that. But we do reach out to Congress, which is the people's part of the
Right.
government, and we do submit quarterly reports to them, and we do give them information and access to our database. These are the congressmen and senators that we work with, in particular Tim Burchett from Tennessee and Andre Carson, Representative Andre Carson from Indiana. We consider them allies of MUFON. As a matter of fact, there was just a secret hearing 2 days ago. And Tim Burchett came out of it. It was with the Inspector General of Intelligence for the United States government, the division that David Grush came out of in the whistleblower hearings in July. And basically, Tim Burchett said, "I'm still not very impressed with what we're learning. I give this secret hearing a 4 stars out of 10," which made me chuckle because
Who said this?
Tim Burchett, the representative from Tennessee.
Yeah.
He said it was he'd rate the secret hearing 2 days ago, 4 out of 10 stars. So he believes that Congress is really getting stonewalled by the military and that they just don't want to legally tell Congress anything that's going on.
Why?
I have a couple of theories on it. I don't know why. It's like part of me thinks the whole thing's a big psyop. Part of me thinks that if the government does have crash material and they're back engineering it, they can't tell us. And there's some people who believe that we're actually working with whoever these visitors are, and it has to be kept top secret. I don't think it's because they're afraid civilization's going to fall apart and religions are going to fall apart. I think people are far too savvy today compared to like 75 years ago. So I don't think that would be an adequate reason not to tell us. There's something else going on. It's either some sort of disinformation campaign by the government, or they're hiding something because it's necessary for hopefully the benefit of the United States.
Well, I would say that yeah, they like to tell you and me and the public that they're in charge. Humans are the top of the food chain, and they don't want us to know that that's a lie. They don't want us to know that there's other species out there, entities, whatever you want to call them, that's and we don't know what who they are, what they are, where they're from, what their agenda is. And that's scary if you stop and think about it. But when you take the average citizen across around the world, they are going to be frightened, sometimes, you know, possibly frightened to death when they find out, yeah, we're not the top of the food chain. There are others out there. But, you know, I've said it, many other investigators have said it, many people have said it. If they wanted to take us over with their abilities to go through other dimensions or across time and space, it would have already happened.
I agree with you 100%.
So, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So,
but one of my pet theories is that at least some of these visitors, they might be human time travelers, and it would be more than one group of time travelers. And I believe that their missions, if they are missions, are fairly nefarious. I believe it's nothing short of trying to alter our timeline for some reason, which is, I think, frightening.
Yeah, but at the same time, the paradox of that is that if they were able to do so, they wouldn't be needing to come back or able to come back, and we wouldn't see them.
Well, if you go by the multiverse theory, it would actually whatever they change would create a new timeline. The timelines would diverge at that point, which, I mean, that's hard to grasp, you know, put your head around it. But there'd be, you know, in one universe, 9/11 never happened. In one universe, 9/11 happened, and so on and so on. And in quantum mechanics, there's an infinite amount of possibilities. But I definitely think someone's screwing around with our timeline. That's my personal opinion, because I've seen enough evidence and I've written enough articles about it that I have it pretty clear in my head that things are not what they seem.
Will that theory be in your book as well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm trying to finish up this particular chapter right now. I want to give it to Outer Limits magazine for their February issue, and I'm running out of time. But basically, I'll just give you one quick story. Elon Musk and Wernher von Braun, there are multiple connections between them that shouldn't exist. And probably the most famous one that people know about is that when Wernher von Braun came to the United States under Operation Paperclip, he spent some time working on, you know, secret military programs for the United States government in New Mexico. In 1948, he published a novel about how humans would go to Mars one day. And the name of the book is called Project Mars, A Technical Tale. It was written in 48 and it was published in 53. And basically chapter 24 or 28 talks about how Mars would be governed, and the leader of the Mars colony would be called the Elon, E-L-O-N. Okay, that's fascinating enough, except that if you look at the similarities between a V2 rocket and Elon Musk's Starship that he wants to take to Mars, it's more than a coincidence. And also, towards the end of von Braun's life, he told his private secretary, Dr. Carol Rosen, that he believed what's going on now and in the future with aliens would be the militarization of space, and that it would include fake alien invasions. It's quite technically possible now that in the 21st century, Project Bluebeam is feasible. Okay, if you look at the origin of Starlink, Starlink originally came out of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, and it was going to be a series of satellites that would encompass around the Earth, sort of like a net, and it was going to be called Operation Brilliant Pebbles, and these satellites would be able to take out enemy satellites in groups. And if you look at the original drawings for Operation Brilliant Pebbles satellites, they look exactly like Elon Musk's Starlink. They're identical. So I think that there's a more nefarious reason for Starlink than providing internet service to people all over the world. And there are also numerous links, temporal links across time, that suggest somehow Elon Musk and Wernher von Braun crossed paths. When von Braun built the V2 rocket, he was asked how he did it. He said, "We had help." But he never went further in his cryptic answer. Okay, so if he's at war with the world and Germany had the most sophisticated scientists of the time, it certainly wasn't the United States or the Soviet Union helping him. So who
No.
did help him? And in Cindy Tautfest's Hayden Hughes collection, there is a letter from Hughes to von Braun asking von Braun his thoughts on aliens. And von Braun blew him off and said, I don't believe in aliens. That's ridiculous. There's no such thing. So if it's not aliens, who helped Wernher von Braun? The premise of my article is that I believe Elon Musk may have helped Wernher von Braun. But how is the question?
Through time, right?
Yep.
Wow. And like you say, it's a bit difficult to wrap your head around it, but this whole phenomenon is difficult to wrap your head around, right?
It never ceases to amaze me, the stuff that comes out. Last year, in our Cases of Interest presentation, we went deep. We did a deep dive into the story that nobody talked about last year. Everybody talked about the congressional hearings, but nobody talked about what happened the week after the Chinese balloon was shot down. Apparently, NORAD tweaked a lot of their radar systems and they saw stuff that they didn't know what it was. And they ended up shooting down three objects over North America. Do you recall that? In February of last year?
Basically, yeah.
And one of them they shot down over Alaska, one of them they shot down over the Yukon, and one of them they shot down over Lake Huron. Okay. Nobody has ever seen the fighter jet footage, although in any fighter jet engagement, especially with an unknown, fighter jet footage is taken from the underbelly of the craft. They've refused all FOIA requests about it. So it's either something so embarrassing that they shot down like more weather balloons, or it's something so frightening they can't talk about it. But what was interesting was that the object that was shot down over Lake Huron was octagon shaped, according to the pilot. And what we did was we went into the MUFON's 135,000 cases and we found numerous octagon shaped objects. And not only that, a lot of the witnesses drew what they saw, and all of the objects had similarities. They were all no bigger than 60 feet, no smaller than 11 feet, no larger than 60 feet. And on the bottom, they all had different patterns of red, yellow, orange, and white lights. So we can assume that these objects are either the same object or objects of similar construction. The weirdest thing about it is exactly where the object was shot down over Lake Huron near the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. 2 years earlier, somebody reported an octagon in exactly the same place. So there's no doubt that there are octagon-shaped objects flying around the United States. And the other interesting thing about it is that in all of these reports, they were within several miles of very, very sensitive strategic military bases, including special war ops in San Diego.
Yeah, Lake Huron is right in my backyard here in Michigan. We're in Dearborn, Michigan, or Detroit, in the Detroit area. So I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, Station Making Waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with Mr. Robert Spearing, MUFON's head of Project Aquarius. And we're discussing that. And tell us about the cooperative between MUFON in America and Europe.
Okay, well, this is how MUFON set up outside the United States. Within the United States, we have state directors for every state. If we don't have a director or a field investigator in a certain state, we have what's called a case assistance group. Team CAG for short. Now, outside the United States, we don't have state directors. We have national directors, but we don't have national directors in, I think it's 22 national directors we have right now. And there's like 180 something countries, if I recall correctly. So we have what's called the Case Assistance Group International, which is a group of field investigators that will do cases in countries that that are very remote, like Morocco might get one report a year. South Africa might get five reports per year. And so we have a special team to cover that if we don't have a field investigator or a national director in those countries. But as far as, let's say, the Five Eyes, the United States, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, we have a lot of UFO sightings. We have national directors and a bevy of field investigators in those countries. So it's very easy to investigate in first world countries. All right. Canada, probably after the United States, gets the second most amount of cases, followed by England and France. And France is a special case. They have a very, very solid team, and the French are very, very open to UFOs. So we always have a healthy cadre of field investigators in France, and we get an enormous amount of really, really interesting cases from France. The hard thing about France is that the reports are always in French. So we have to, if the Americans want to read them and see if they're a good case, we have to use Google Translate. Surprisingly, you would think that a country like Brazil would have a lot of UFO reports and a lot of people who would want to be field investigators. We don't. We only have one person, and we don't get that many cases from Brazil. And we can't figure out why, because Brazil has a population of over 250 million people, and they have a very keen interest in UFOs. But we get very few members, and we get very few cases from Brazil, and we've never been able to figure out why.
I thought there were a lot of cases in Brazil.
They don't come to MUFON, though. All right. So I've always suspected that there's some sort of other UFO organization in Brazil that's pretty much taken away, you know, MUFON's, you know, business there, I guess.
You have to get to the bottom of this, Bob.
Yeah, I have to learn to speak Portuguese.
About how many countries would you say are involved in this data gathering?
I'd say Asia gives us a pretty fair amount of cases too. We get cases from Japan. We get very few from China. Japan, South Korea, we get a lot of cases from Taiwan. We get a lot of cases from overall, I'd say that probably 40 countries out of 183 provide us with the majority of reports that we get, and I'm including the United States in that. Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned 183. Is that?
Yes, we get very few from Africa. We get very few from Islamic countries, and that's understandable, because a lot of times when people send in a report from, say, Yemen, for example, they're very frightened that someone will find out that they're reporting a UFO. Okay, Turkey also, people are afraid to report and will say that in their reports. I'm really afraid of the government finding out that I'm reporting this because I'm a Muslim. And so it's very interesting what goes on in the Muslim countries and in the African countries. The only countries we actually get reports from in Africa are Egypt, and we get a fair amount from Egypt and South Africa. Other than that, one from Botswana in like 5 years, perhaps.
So the Muslim countries, for example, the Muslims have this taboo on UFOs because of their religion.
I get, that's the sense I get when I read some of the people who send in reports, that they're afraid that they're going to get in trouble for doing it.
Wow.
Yeah, and China, we only get like three or four reports a year from China. And I know that no other UFO organizations get reports from China either.
You know, faith is faith, and I respect all religions. But fact is fact, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and you have to take that into consideration, too. But there you go. Have you ever presented any of the more compelling cases to the Pentagon or Congress?
Yes.
Not the Pentagon.
Not to the Pentagon, no, to Congress. I mean, MUFON has a long history, okay? And, you know, if we're going to be honest, no organization goes, you know, 50 plus years without having some sort of scandal along the way. And the major one for MUFON was 15, 20 years ago when we briefly teamed up with Robert Bigelow, the billionaire, who actually paid MUFON for reports. And that was such a tragic mistake on MUFON's part, because Bigelow was sort of, you know, connected to the military and such that the relationship was, I think, severed in less than a year. And we never went back that way at all. And we remained independent up until probably 2017, when all hell started to break loose with the, you know, the pilot reports and the creation of Arrow and the congressional hearings. And we offered our services to Congress and they accepted. So I've written a report for Congress basically on the octagons, and we've given them several other very intriguing cases of interest along the way. If I've got time, I'll tell you one in particular.
Please.
Okay. Back in 2019, there was a FedEx plane, and it was going from Mexico City to Tennessee. And the manifest said that it was carrying auto parts from a Ford auto plant in Mexico City to a Ford plant in Tennessee. When the FedEx plane, 747, was hugging the Gulf of Mexico coast going north towards Monterrey in Mexico, a yellow ball of light came down on the co-pilot's side of the plane and began accompanying the plane for 33 minutes. The ball of light was literally outside the cockpit window, and it stayed with them. They were going 500 miles an hour. They were 33,000 feet. And the pilot, Eric Delgado, who had a lot of military experience, he flew tanker refueling planes during the Iraqi war, sometimes refueling fighter jets in absolute blackness. So this guy had a good idea of what he was seeing out the window, but he was very cool. Most people, when they have a UFO sighting, they'll go, "I was so scared," or "I was so fascinated, I forgot to pull out my camera." Well, Mr. Delgado pulled out his camera, turned off the lights in the cockpit, and then filmed the thing for 4 minutes. And at the end of the video, he did something really, really incredible. He panned away from the object down to his console. And on his console is what's called the TCAS anti-collision radar. And basically, the screen shows if anything's coming close to you that you could collide with. And basically, it showed that there was nothing on his radar, even though the object was right outside the window. When they get to the United States border, the object makes a sharp left turn and shoots away from the airplane instead of going across into the United States, all right, which tells me it was intelligently controlled. Mm-hmm. We reached out to Ted Rowe. I don't know if you know Ted Rowe from NARCAP.
I had him on my show just recently.
Oh, okay. He came up with a brilliant theory, and that was that it was actually a technical aircraft, spherical shaped, because the pilot described it having a tail. And Ted Rowe told us if a ball of plasma has a tail, it tells you there's something inside it. Okay, so why would a metallic sphere, intelligently controlled, be surrounded by plasma? Well, Ted Rowe said that plasma absorbs radar signals, which is why it didn't show up on the TCAS, okay? Mm-hmm. So right now, the American military is experimenting with shooting plasma fields in front of their F-35s. So if they were going on a mission, say, to bomb something in Iran, and Iran's got their missile array with the radar looking for the American planes, the radar signal will be absorbed by the plasma field in front of the F-35, making it invisible, all right? So it all makes sense except one thing. If this object was that sophisticated that it could hide itself from a TCAS radar, why did it avoid going across the United States border? Did it know we had something more sophisticated than it? Okay, so here's the clincher. Ted Rowe writes, Chris Mellon tweets that this is a very, very important MUFON case that should be investigated further. Ted Rowe puts out a white paper on it, and his website almost crashes that day. And he told me that the majority of the hits that he got came from two places on Earth, Washington, D.C., and mainland China. So if that doesn't show you that there was something interesting about that, you know, ball of fire next to a FedEx 747, I don't know what does. And we gave that report to Congress also.
That is something. That is something. Have any other whistleblowers other than David Grush come forward to share their testimony with MUFON?
No, you know, I guess the original whistleblower was Lou Elizondo,
right.
and he spoke at our 2018 symposium in New Jersey when he was, you know, a hot ticket back then. Mm-hmm. Grush has never come to MUFON. I don't think he ever will. But we do get a substantial number of pilot and military cases. The ones from the Vietnam War in the South China Sea are fascinating, what some of the sailors saw coming in and out of the South China Sea. But I just heard an interesting story about Grush yesterday. And basically, he was flown into a private party recently. I think it was in Connecticut. And at that party, he began telling partygoers that the United States is in possession of a football field-sized UFO. All right. Now, this is different than his story in July, where he said we had crash debris, but he didn't ever mention how big it was. He mentioned crash debris and non-human biologics, entity remains, I guess, is what he's talking about. But he never mentioned that we possessed a football field-sized craft. And interestingly enough, the majority of triangle craft reports that MUFON gets, the description that most people give is it was bigger than a football field. So I'm wondering if they have a triangle, and that's what he was talking about at that party.
Yeah, maybe he got to a party, had a couple of drinks, and loosened his tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know. Now, of course, that wasn't under oath like it was in Congress.
That's correct, yes.
But he was under oath in Congress. And go ahead. Who did I have on the show? At any rate, I discussed it on the show about David Grush. And when he was at the congressional hearing, Congressional Representative Fox, just kind of cut him off and said, Kirkpatrick said, we don't have any crash discs. Was he telling the truth? And he said he wasn't exactly honest about that. Well, she says, I believe he was, and it just wouldn't listen to him at all.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of friction between Kirkpatrick and Grush, where Kirkpatrick said, I've invited him to speak with Arrow many times and he declined. And Grush would say, no, he never invited me to speak once. So one of them's lying, all right? The other interesting thing is that when Kirkpatrick started as head of Arrow, initially he came out and said, we see no evidence that UFOs exist. When Kirkpatrick left Arrow suddenly, retiring suddenly last month, this in December, mm-hmm. his parting statement was very cryptic. He said, they're on our doorstep. That's quite a departure from what he said a year earlier when he said there's no evidence. So was he trying to tell us something? Did he have a change of heart? The other interesting thing about Arrow, to this day, when you read newspaper articles about him, the newspaper articles say Arrow has investigated over 800 cases. That's the same number they were using 365 days ago. Have they not investigated any other cases past the 800? They've never come to MUFON. We have 135,000 cases. We'd be willing to, you know, open up and let them look at it to see if there's patterns or whatever, but they don't contact us. And I don't think they will. I don't think they will.
Well, that's why I was asking if you contacted them.
No, we've not reached out to Arrow. No, at least not yet. Because we have so many pilot sightings, You know, we've had discussions saying, you know, they're going to start having a portal where pilots can report cases to them. Why don't they ask us? Because we've got so many pilot cases that, you know, we could offer them, you know, but nothing's come of that. But what we are going to do is in the near future, we're going to be putting up buttons on our website for pilot cases and for military cases. We get them anyway, but we're going to make it more specific because look at what's happening to ufology right now. For years, all right, after KUFOS became legacy and NICAP became legacy, the only two real organizations that collect UFO reports was NUFORC, Peter Davenport, and MUFON, all right? Now, all of a sudden, you've got Peter Davenport, you've got MUFON, you've got NASA has a website where you can report items to them. Arrow's got a website that where they specifically want pilot and military reports. And now even private corporations are getting into the act. This corporation, Enigma Labs, they're taking reports. So what's happening is all of the UFO reports around the world are dispersing to various groups that don't cooperate with each other. So how can you ever get realistic, accurate statistics from this point on with so many people trying to grab UFO reports? All I can tell you is that MUFON and NUFORC, we make our reports public. Okay, NASA, Arrow, and private corporations, they're under no compunction to ever do so. So if you're reporting your UFO report to them, you might not ever find out what happened to it. With MUFON, at least, we have an investigator call you up, go through and interview you, tell you anything you want to know, you know, do we have correlating cases? And because we consider ourselves free, grassroots, and open.
Really? No, it was Stephen Bassett that I was talking to and I about Fox, Congresswoman Fox. And I said, you know, here is Grush under oath telling you that he's got the goods, so to speak. Kirkpatrick isn't in there. Get Kirkpatrick in there. I'll put him under oath. Have him fight that out. Somebody's lying. Yeah, but like you say, Kirkpatrick's kind of changing his tune now.
I'd love to get him to come speak at a MUFON symposium. I'd like to hear his change of heart. What made him, you know, have a parting comment like they're on our doorstep? What does that mean exactly? That's a pretty scary thing to say as you're getting booted out the door.
Well, they are. That's adverb that, what is he talking about? Who's they? Can you be more specific? I don't know. So anyway, when is this book coming out, Bob?
Oh, I don't know. I'd like to get it done sometime this year. Every time I think I got one last chapter to go, I end up having another chapter to go. I want to add a chapter on portals, all right? So it's over 400 pages right now. Okay. So, yeah, I'm hoping maybe by the symposium, because I'll be speaking at the symposium, so they give everybody a table there. I'd love to get it done by July so that I can you know, push it at the symposium. So, and the working title right now is The Architects of Fear, which was episode two, an episode in the inaugural season of the original Outer Limits series in 1963 with Robert Culp, where they try to pull off a fake alien invasion, The Architects of Fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what was predicted by... you just said his name.
Well, Wernher von Braun predicted it in the 70s. And then I think the fellow's name who wrote Project Bluebeam, Claude Monset, he basically predicted it also. And this was in the 90s. So there was actually a television episode about a fake alien invasion as early as 1963, prior to von Braun. Yeah.
So before that book, which I want a copy of, where can our listeners go to find out more about your work and Project Aquarius?
Well, MUFON offers all sorts of benefits, memberships. You can get a Project Aquarius library card for just $50 without ever joining MUFON. MUFON membership goes as inexpensively as $60 a year, and you get a monthly magazine, a biweekly newsletter, some other perks. And also, if you ever want to become a field investigator, it was probably one of the greatest things I ever did in my life. It's changed my outlook on the universe. And it requires buying a book and taking a test, and then we start assigning you cases wherever you are in the world. So for any of those interests you might have, the Project Aquarius Library, joining MUFON as a member, or becoming a field investigator, you simply go to www.mufon.com. It's that simple. If you want to report a UFO, www.mufon.com. Click up in the upper right-hand corner, report a UFO or report an abduction. That easy. MUFON.com.
Mr. Robert Spearing, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Mr. David Twitchell, thank you for having me so much. I appreciate it, sir.
And when that book comes out, we'll get together and we'll discuss that too.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.